This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
You are listening to a programme from BBC Radio 4.
So here we have a flight entering Scottish airspace from America. We can see its original flight plan route, which is quite a sort of circuitous route down to southern England.
Hidden in an industrial site on Britain's south coast, engineers are developing a system that they hope will revolutionise plane travel. It starts with a bank of computer screens, simulating a new kind of air traffic control. Displayed on them is an array of small arrowheads representing planes and black lines predicting each flight path, crisscrossing a sector of the UK's airspace.
So this is a visualization of what the system's doing for us. It's calculating a trajectory into the future.
An arrow basically pointing forwards came shooting out and shows its path.
Exactly. We can look at the path the aircraft is going to fly. We can look at what time the aircraft is going to be over each point and what level, etc.
Much of the global aviation industry is pinning its hopes on this system. It's a revolution in the way that passenger aircraft, upon reaching their cruising height, are guided and controlled around the globe. In this vision of the future, pilots are given the freedom to quite literally choose their own routes through our crowded skies, instead of following one another along long-established flight corridors. And the result?
Well, we can see that it's going to arrive at that position on the Welsh border 4 minutes earlier than the original route.
So it's saving 4 minutes on its trip, just that little part of its trip across that part of the UK.
And that 4 minutes saves time, obviously saves fuel, saves emissions.
On the face of it, allowing pilots to fly their own routes sounds mad. For a start, the risk of collisions would appear to rise hugely. But new technological developments mean that what is known in the industry as free routing is not only possible, but long overdue.
Now we are at a point where there's so much technology on board the aeroplane that it can work out what its best route will be, but we still control aeroplanes as if it's 1955. We talk to pilots using VHF radio, and we survey whether or not the aircraft are there by using radar. All technology that was invented before World War II and perfected during World War II, which is really quite incredible.
It's a tried and tested system, but in this edition of Frontiers, we'll be exploring new technology poised to finally overhaul air traffic control and flight navigation. Will it safely increase the capacity of our airspace, allowing the expansion that airline operators are demanding? As we'll hear, it could ultimately lead to fully automated planes and, some say, even open the door to the pilotless plane. In the interim, the advantages of an updated air traffic control system should improve the journey both for passengers and for airlines, with the promise of more direct flights, an end to holding patterns above airports, and reduced fuel use, leading to cost savings and lower emissions.
Essentially, you can predict your arrival time to within seconds. From the kind of studies I've carried out, I would probably say 30 seconds is probably a realistic target.
To have that sort of guaranteed arrival time is going to be a huge improvement over what we currently have.
Especially if you're talking about the arrival time at the gate as opposed to at the arrival time on the airport surface.
Every year, over 1.6 billion passengers take one of Europe's annual 10 million flights. With traffic projected to hit 16.9 million by 2030, more flights could mean more delays, greater safety concerns, increased costs for airlines, and higher CO2 emissions.
The European Union is on a mission to completely overhaul Europe's fragmented airspace and its air traffic management. The complex skies are currently monitored by 60 traffic control centres, and they're reaching the limit of their capacity. CESAR, or the Single European Sky Air Traffic Research Body, may sound as though it's trying to reclaim some of the glamour of the glory days of air travel as it promotes its aims, but it also highlights the concerns about expected growing aviation traffic, delays, and inefficiencies. Its answer? To create cooperation between a reduced number of control centres and, crucially, to revamp the way we control flights. It's something that Wolfgang Schuster of Imperial College London, a researcher in air traffic management, has been studying. Armed with a real-time 3D image of a typical day in the European skies, some of the world's busiest airspace, he graphically demonstrates what's wrong with the current picture.
We're talking about 30,000 flights, and 70% of those fly in 14% of the core airspace.
So you've zoomed in on the map a little bit here, and we can see the outline of Europe underneath. And what looks like just each dot of these planes is like a little ant just marching across this map. Some of them are following straight line paths, some of them don't seem to be.
It may look quite chaotic, but it is, in fact, a very structured organization. In going from A to B, they will have to follow a specific route, which may not necessarily be the direct route.
Why is that?
It is basically a way of managing the air traffic. Given the current density of air traffic in Europe, it is not always very easy to manage this amount of traffic. And the key limitation here tends to be the controller workload on the ground. So in order to enable them to manage this traffic safely, they have predefined routes along which the air traffic is required to fly.
These flight routes originate from an antiquated system and to a large extent are responsible for some airspace at least appearing crowded, despite there being a huge volume of sky up there. Roger Connor is an aviation historian at the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C. He says you can trace this all back to a fight in the 1950s between the U.S. and Britain over what the primary navigation system would be for air traffic.
There were two competing visions of what this would be. The American system was a much more conservative approach, and it was based upon the routing that had emerged in the 1920s and 30s in the United States to move the airmail from coast to coast. Essentially an electronic version of the old lighted beacons. You would simply put an aircraft on a route from one beacon to the other. Whereas in the UK during the Second World War, a very promising new system had emerged. The concept was not all that different than what we do with GPS today, in that you could navigate over broad areas and still be able to determine your fix. And unfortunately, post-war American hegemony in this area really pushed the UN in the form of the International Civil Aviation Organization to adopt the American system over the British system. And so for the past 60 years, we've been using a system that, while very robust and dependable, is not very flexible and very difficult to improve in efficiency. And so that's where we are right now. We're trying to break the chains of this old infrastructure that allows us to move much more freely.
With the advent of powerful computers and navigation satellites, and a flexible approach to the way in which we divide and use our airspace, change seems inevitable. At London's Gatwick or Heathrow airports, you can see the aircraft being guided by controllers in the tower, looking out of the window, making sure that planes are safe on the ground. But around 30 seconds after takeoff, as aircraft ascend above 4,000 feet, the flight is passed to a radar controller. Not on site, as you might expect, but actually some distance away, here at NATS, the National Air Traffic Management Center, at Swanwick, just outside Southampton. Together with its partner centre in Prestwick, Scotland, it's responsible for controlling air traffic across the whole of UK civilian and military airspace.
Easy 16 Mike Tango, when ready, descend flight level 210.
When ready, descend flight level 210, Easy 16 Mike Tango.
My father was an air traffic controller, and as a child, I was sometimes allowed to accompany him to work. And my memory is of banks of men in a darkened room, peering intently into backlit screens and pushing multicolored strips of paper up a board to keep track of the planes above our heads. As he reminded me, it was blue for westbound, buff for eastbound, and pink for crossover flights. Now, that was some decades ago. Yet here at Swanwick, that same system is still used in the ops room, controlling airspace in the immediate crowded vicinity of London. The wider airspace, everything else south of Hadrian's Wall, is controlled from this newer room. This time it's brightly lit, and controllers have several screens at each workstation to keep track of. But the basic underlying principle is the same. Their task is to control safe separation of planes, avoiding what are rather benignly called conflicts, potential collisions in midair. Dave Curtis is head of ops here at NATS.
Probably only 15 years ago, we were literally sitting here, and we'd have been stood in front of a screen with bits of paper with people writing on them, recognising conflictions by moving the paper around. Now we're sitting in an electronic system where you can look ahead of the aircraft, so they take away a lot of the safety risks we used to have in the past.
I think one of the things that I don't get from this screen is the three dimensions, of course. We've got height in there as well, whereas at the moment we're just seeing a lot of planes all stacked up, look like right on top of each other.
It's the ability to be able to think in three dimensions, if you like. You have to put it in context of the pilot and the plane, not necessarily what you can see on a screen.
And all of that is done by the controllers, by the person who would be sat at this workstation. They tell the plane what route to take. They have these flight paths in the sky, effectively, and they have to manage those and make sure the planes are using them efficiently but staying within them.
Rule of thumb, controllers will operate up to, depending on the sector, somewhere between 40 and 50 aircraft in an hour safely in a managed environment using the structured airspace that we have today, using the equipment we have today.
Skipper 82, London Control, good afternoon. Heading 315 on conversion 270 knots or less.
The controllers currently plan safe routes and communicate them to pilots by voice over VHF radio.
H2, could you confirm that's a speed of 315 converting or something else?
Steeper 82, negative, heading 315.
But even under ideal circumstances, they can be misheard. Factor in interference or language barriers, and they could become misinterpreted. Which raises the question, how feasible is it to fit more aircraft in the sky as is being demanded? The aviation industry is notoriously, and perhaps thankfully, heavily regulated to maintain stringent safety rules. The answer being proposed is free routing, allowing pilots, once they reach high altitude, to fly their own chosen routes and yet still avoid one another. It sounds counterintuitive, but the key is communication. As long as everyone is telling everyone else where they are and where they know they will definitely be, potential conflicts can be spotted long in advance. The software needed to do that is being developed by Spanish technology company Indra, which is working with NATS to create an environment which will allow free routing across vast stretches of the globe. Airlines and pilots will be free to select the most direct path, and then the software will predict the entire route of every plane in advance, in a sense producing an aviation-controlled time machine. Gonzalo Martin leads the engineering team at Indra.
What we have here and the concept of free routing is, if there would be a system that provides the idea of where the traffic will be and not where the traffic is at the moment, aircrafts could fly not following this route, but more direct routes, which are always the preferred routes by the pilots and by the companies, because the system will help the controller know where the aircraft will be, and knowing where all the aircraft will be, it will have the controller tell, okay, you've got conflicts between this aircraft, you know this in advance, and you can create a plan based on this idea.
So it's not just relying on the controller and their mental facilities
exactly.
To try and map these flight paths. It's using a computer to try and do that.
Exactly. What we're trying to introduce here with this system is a paradigm shift, trying to know where the aircraft will be at every time.
By 2017, it will be compulsory for planes in Europe to be fitted with satellite navigation for pilots to determine their position. Its greater accuracy could be used to allow aircraft to fly closer together more safely and theoretically allow more planes to be in the air at the same time. Andrew Charlton is head of Aviation Advocacy, a Swiss-based aviation consultancy company. He says that the improvement over traditional radar systems means it will be possible to free up unused flight paths at these high altitudes.
The historical requirement to go over particular waypoints to be able to be sure you were navigating in the right place or that you had navigated to the right place falls away. And of course, we can now also surveil the aircraft, as we say, not just using radar, which of course is very limited. It's based on the ground, so it doesn't work overseas and over water and what have you. It can't do things in 3D. It can't distinguish one sort of aircraft from another. All those sorts of things, they start to fall away with new 3D holographic radar, which is a wonderful British invention, and also with satellite surveillance, effectively, where the aircraft can know where it is.
It's this data, fed by a crucial data link from the plane to ground control centres and to other planes in the vicinity, that means flights can then be managed in advance, based on where it's known the aircraft will be at any particular time in the future. Surrounded by banks of screens receiving information from radar and satellite, Gonzalo Martin began by simulating control of a central sector of Scottish airspace.
So each one of these dots is a plane flying in. So I can see the outline of Scotland underneath there. So this is a plane flying from the Atlantic.
So it's flying through the Atlantic up through Glasgow, and you would be able to see what the aircraft will do at each moment.
So you just click on it there, and suddenly the entire path that aircraft is going to follow has sprung up on the screen.
It's more than the entire path, because we've got the actual route, the time at which the system is predicting each point will be overflown.
Oh, yes, I can see. So 12.06 is where he's going to hit the coast and then leave the other coast.
Exactly. So in this case...
12.34.
So basically, this is a flavor which, just by clicking on here, we know what the aircraft is going to do at every moment, at which level is the aircraft going to enter into our airspace. At which level is the aircraft going to exit our airspace?
Because that's, of course, always the thing with air traffic controllers. You've got that third dimension, which is so hard to show on a screen.
Exactly. That's the complicated part. Putting all the information together in the same place, helping this traffic picture to be created. We're trying to reduce the workload of the controllers.
When it was a command and control system, the controller had to do all of the work, and the pilots were stuck, often knowing more than the controller, but unable to intervene. Now the controller knows precisely what the aircraft is programmed to do, where it's going, and can work it out beforehand and can resolve issues which appear before him when they really show up as conflicts. Whereas previously, he had a screen full of potential conflicts right there. So we've brought the intelligence forward, and then we've also brought the intelligence closer to the aeroplane. And that means that the aircraft can start to dictate things like the most efficient route, the fuel-efficient route, the route that works best in the concept of the network.
It sounds good in theory, and the system is being gradually tried out in very specific circumstances before a large-scale test in Scottish airspace towards the end of next year. Then, engineers like Hamilton Gross, a systems manager at Indra, will be able to assess the true efficiency. For now, he's helping test it on the simulator and demonstrates another immediate benefit by picking a desirable route a plane is likely to choose.
What if we were to give it a direct route right down by the Welsh border? We can first evaluate and see if there's any conflicts there. And if there's no problem, then we can enter the direct route into the system. And in this particular case, when I enter that direct route in, well, we can see that it's going to arrive at that position on the Welsh border 4 minutes earlier than the original route.
So it's saving 4 minutes on its trip, just that little part of its trip across that part of the UK.
And that 4 minutes saves time, obviously saves fuel, saves emissions.
So that would be an example of a user-preferred route. The airline would much prefer to take that direct route.
Exactly. And the system itself will alert us already if there's going to be any potential conflicts in the future.
Because it's monitoring all of these arrows in the background all of the time.
The system is already telling us you've got a problem there.
There you go, and there's a bright red triangle in the middle that shows where they're going to intersect.
Exactly, so we would display all the trajectories of the aircraft involved in the conflict and the part of the trajectory which is actually in conflict. I'm changing the fixed point where the aircraft will be. I'm going to probe it.
So you're basically testing what a new flight path for that plane would look like before you give the order to take that path and make sure it doesn't create yet another conflict.
That's exactly the intention of it.
Everything on the screen has gone back to reassuringly black lines.
Exactly.
The system will tell the controller where conflicts will occur hours ahead for an entire flight's route, and then it will create flight paths that are free of conflicts by modifying altitude, heading, or speed. It effectively gives the controllers a way to see into the future. And, says Wolfgang Schuster, it therefore gives them new powers of prediction.
One of the issues with the current system is that it is very tactical. You react to an event that happens, but fairly close to the point in time at which it happens, which may mean that your options are fairly limited at that point in time. For example, I mean, two aircraft on a collision course, which if you have only 5 minutes to correct it, you have less options than if you can predict this collision course an hour in advance, for example. So you have a lot more options if you take a much more strategic approach.
So time sort of becomes the fourth dimension in this planning then?
Time is a very important dimension, as a matter of fact, because by being strategic, what it really means is that you're now proposing a trajectory ahead of your flight, which is then being shared between the various airspace users. And before you start your flight, you get an agreement for a specific trajectory. And each airspace user is required to stick to that specific trajectory.
So, welcome to a new era of 4D air travel. To an outsider, It sounds like it's making the system more complex because of so many requests for so many different routes at high altitude, rather than the current system of nice, neat motorways in the sky. Julie Cranch, head of advanced tool development at NATS Control Center in Swanwick, says it's a future being made possible because of computing power and communication.
It's about information sharing. It's about every actor within the ATM environment giving access to the right information at the right time to make the right decision, and everybody's working off the same piece of information.
Because I guess potentially a lot of this could be done quite far in advance. I can book a plane ticket for 3 months' time and know that I'm due to depart at 10:35 and, you know, on a Tuesday or whatever. It's surprising that it hasn't gone that next step almost, in that then my whole route will be planned.
I mean, currently, obviously, there are schedules that are made well in advance, 6 months to 12 months, that would still happen. But as you move forward in time, T-8, T-4, you'd be refining the plan all of the time because things are likely to change. We need to optimise the system. We need some flexibility to cope with any eventuality within air traffic that may go wrong. For instance, there could be a runway that's closed for whatever reason, which will affect the network, which will affect the plan. We need to have some flexibility in there to be able to deal with that as well.
But flexibility implies an amount of uncertainty, and this system relies on accurate positioning in space and time. Bad weather causing turbulence, or ice, or even erupting volcanoes can't always be accurately predicted far ahead. At Imperial College, Wolfgang Schuster is improving predictive software for air traffic controllers and for the onboard flight management system, and he's looking into this issue. He says that the uncertainty can and must be managed to stop the computer either overcautiously warning about potential conflicts or, even worse, missing them.
You may actually get quite a lot of false alerts. Now, if you try to implement such a system, very soon you'll realize that the human element, that is to say the air traffic controller or even the flight crew, may say, well, the system clearly doesn't work. Why should we use this system?
Or it simply overloads them even more than the current system does if it's constantly flashing up false alarms.
Correct. We need to have a much better understanding of the uncertainties in that process of predicting, and to better predict, as a result, what these trajectories are.
So this is effectively the intelligent software that's running in the background, keeping this whole thing running smoothly, and what you're doing is making sure that we can trust it.
So if you're talking about the planning stages, which can sometimes typically be over several months, a lot of more uncertainties associated with that. For example, due to the fact that you have a lot more uncertainties associated with the environmental conditions like temperature, pressure, winds. And therefore, as you go along through the trajectory refinement process, you get more and more accurate information. And you then use that information to feed into the decision support tools to narrow down, let's say, your uncertainty bubble around the aircraft. And on the basis of that, you enhance essentially the efficiency and the robustness of your trajectory prediction process.
And in a similar way to vehicle-to-vehicle communication being proposed on the ground to make driving safer, once airborne, plane-to-plane data transfer can lead to other, even more futuristic possibilities. Andrew Charlton.
If an aircraft is flying through a particular patch of weather, it can tell other aircraft of the weather, and the aircraft can start making dynamic changes to avoid it or to take advantage of the high wind. So the aircraft moves from being the end of a spoke, if you like, in the network to being a node in a network and starts to communicate both with the airline company but also with other aircraft in the area. At the moment, it's a stunning truth that a pilot flying an aeroplane on a long sector from Los Angeles to Sydney, say, 14 and a half, 15 hours into the wind, gets weather which by the time he arrives in Sydney, he or she arrives in Sydney, is in the order of 20 hours out of date. He's better off, or she's better off, taking their iPad down into the passenger cabin using the Wi-Fi that's available on board the aeroplane, because they'd actually get more up-to-date weather than they're getting up in the cockpit. It is a remarkable situation.
And on that basis, change seems inevitable. But how far will advances take us? If much of ground control is handed over to computers, we could envision a day where there are no air traffic controllers, or perhaps no pilots, as the job of controlling planes is placed in the hands of technology. Given that it is a notoriously cautious industry where change and new ideas trickle through slowly, researchers are already having to think decades ahead and to start considering the role of automation.
most of our airliners today can be flown essentially autonomously. We can set them to take off on autopilot. We can have them land on autopilot. They can route on autopilot. But obviously, we as humans are very uncomfortable in turning our fates over entirely to a computer. So the place of the pilot and the degree to which this automation is running the routine aspects of flight is very much still an open question. Technically, it's certainly possible to have an unmanned airliner. What we're likely to see and where the push right now is taking place is in autonomous cargo aircraft. So whether that's a UPS or FedEx or other cargo services, they are looking at possibly having autonomous aircraft. And if that occurs, then maybe some decades down the line, we might see more of an interest in autonomous passenger service.
I think it's going to be a big leap, isn't it?
I think it's a significant step, although from a technological perspective, possibly not. Because the technologies, in principle, are there. It is only a matter of whether we are willing to accept and give our lives into the hands of technologies, as opposed to the pilots.
Golf Alpha, Alpha, climb flight level 310.
While a whole-scale switch to free routing is not going to take place overnight, given the caution with which the aviation industry proceeds, the vision is imminent. The European Union aspires to have free routing in operation by 2020. It will operate alongside other big players, NextGen in the US, and the Japanese aviation industry, which is pushing ahead quickly with a similar system.
I think if we looked back 10 years ago and thought we'd have an airway structure with 1.5 million flights flying through this one piece of airspace, we'd have probably thought that was unmanageable too. But we've evolved it over the years. And there's a lot of airspace, as you can see from the picture we're looking at. There's a lot of airspace that isn't being used at all.
It is very concentrated in certain areas, isn't it?
Yes.
And there's a lot of empty space around those areas.
And the more you can make use of the empty space at a higher level in particular, and the more you can take it away from the ground-based navigation aid because the system is there for the air traffic controller and for the pilot, the easier it is for the aircraft to fly around in it.
And, ultimately, that's what we as passengers are likely to notice the most, the fourth dimension being controlled, time. Guaranteed departure and arrival times would be a huge step forwards from the current situation, which can often feel like little more than an estimate. For that to be a reality, similar projects will be needed to ensure airport operations internationally are as efficient as the flights. We may never return to the golden years of stress-free flight, being whisked safely and efficiently to our destinations, but free routing may at least return some of the ease to air travel.
Smoother, more predictable, maybe another word, because essentially, by being strategic, you will know much more accurately when you'll depart, when you'll arrive. Because essentially, we are going from a system which says first come, first served, towards a system which says on time, best served.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.